Father Silvestri was a thin, academic-looking man of around 70, a Jesuit, one of those desiccated priests with a scrawny neck protruding from his collar like a plant out of a pot. There was something grim and old-fashioned about him, an air of suffering and knowledge. He invited Harriet and me to sit down. A red light burned steadily in front of a picture of the Sacred Heart. On one wall, a wooden crucifix hung heavily from a brass hook. "You had better tell me what you know," he said, "and all that has happened between you and Milne." "Where shall I begin?" I asked.
"At the beginning."
When I finally came to a halt, Silvestri seemed shrunken, troubled in spirit.
"It would be unwise to underestimate Duncan Milne," he said. "He is very dangerous indeed. I have outwitted and outmaneuvered him more than once, but I have yet to defeat him. Come over here," he continued. "There are things I have to show you."
He crossed to a locked cabinet in one corner of the room and took out a bundle of dark blue files. Opening the top file, he drew something from it and passed it to me. It was a photograph of a man of about 50, dressed in rather old-fashioned clothes, dating from the 1940s as far as I could tell.
"Do you recognize him?"
Father Silvestri asked. I nodded. "It's Duncan Milne," I said.
"That's his father, Stuart Milne. The photograph was taken in 1943 in London. Now, what about this?"
He passed me a second photograph, this time of a man of about 40, dressed in the clothes of a late Victorian gentleman. This, too, greatly resembled Duncan.
"I take it this is his grandfather." "You're perfectly right. That is Angus Milne. He was born in Edinburgh in 1846 and died in 1908. His son Stuart was born in 1890 and died in 1961. Duncan was born in 1943 and is still living."
He paused and took the photographs from me, passing them to Harriet.
"Those," Father Silvestri continued, "are the basic facts concerning the last three generations of the Milne family. Except that almost none of it is true. Angus certainly was born in 1846. I have seen the entry in the parish register for that year. I have also seen birth certificates for Stuart and Duncan. But many years ago, I began to grow suspicious about the Milne history. The more I asked around, the more I found things that did not fit together. In the end, I analyzed what I knew and discovered something very curious. No one seemed to have seen Angus Milne with his son Stuart after the boy was about 10, and no one had ever seen Stuart with Duncan after about the same age. Stuart appears to have made his first appearance in public around the age of 20. Duncan, when he studied law here at the age of 18. He paused. "It is my firm belief that Angus, Stuart, and Duncan Milne are one and the same person. He has never died, and he means to go on living, reappearing every so often as his own son. I am not talking of reincarnation in any shape or form. Milne is simply rejuvenated, if we may put it that way. The children will have been orphans procured for the purpose of registering the birth and lending substance to the imposture for a while. I fear they will have met their end as soon as they outlive their usefulness."
He went on to explain how Angus Milne, devastated by the death of his first wife Constance, took to the study of the magical arts. After years of getting nowhere, he stumbled on a book that seemed to offer him everything he sought.
"You've seen it," he said to me. "You have Angus's own copy with you in that briefcase."
"The Matrix Aeternitatis. But surely, on the strength of what he read in this book," Silvestri continued,
"Angus Milne travels to Morocco. He found what he was looking for in the person of an occult master in Fez. From this man, he learned how to defy death."
"Sheikh Ahmad," I whispered.
"Precisely. An old man then, and much older now. It's also reported that on returning from Africa, Milne spent a year and more locked in his private rooms at Penshiel House, along with the remains of his wife, trying to bring her back to life. Whether he succeeded or not isn't clear. He paused. There's something else you should know. One of the people who became closely involved with Milne and his circle was a bookseller called Clement Markham. He ran a second-hand and antiquarian business. Around 1975, the shop was raided by the obscene publication squad. I don't know whether they ever found any dirty books, but they did come across the bodies of three small children. Markham was arrested and tried, and in the course of the trial it was suggested that the children had met their fate as sacrifices in rituals conducted by Markham. His connection with Milne came out, of course, but there was never anything to tie the eminent young advocate to the murders. Markham died in prison in 1981. His bookshop has remained empty ever since. Not quite empty, I said. My voice sounded hollow to me. I was shivering inside. While we had been talking, Harriet had been studying the photographs of Milne, both those that I had looked at and the others in Silvestri's thick file. In the silence that followed my remark, she picked one out and looked at it for a short time. "Look at this, Andrew," she said. "This is Angus Milne with his wife, Constance." I took the photograph from her and glanced at it, first at Milne, then at his wife. As I did so, the photograph fell from my hand. I felt myself grow giddy. Harriet put a hand on my arm. "What is it, Andrew? What's the matter?" I pointed numbly at the photograph. "Milne's wife," I said. "She's the double of Katrina. He must have known. Now I know why he had her remains removed from their grave. He failed once. Now he's trying again." We stayed with Silvestri until about 3 o'clock that afternoon. "I'd like you to come back this evening," he said, as we were leaving. "There are some inquiries I have to make. What you have told me has been extremely useful, but you must not forget that you are both in mortal danger." We took a bus back to town. I was still worried about my father, and I'd made an appointment with our old family friend, Ramsay McLean. Harriet wanted to get back home to the Dean village, so I set off alone for his surgery. McLean was waiting for me as arranged. "I hope this isn't inconvenient," I said. "Not at all. I was worried, to tell you the truth, when you said your father was ill. I haven't heard from him in months. Tell me what the problem is." I described my father's symptoms as best I could, and from them moved on to Ian and how he had died. McLean listened patiently to me, nodding from time to time, or grunting. "And you think your father has developed the same mysterious condition?" "It's not that simple," I said. "Oh?" His heavy eyebrows knotted. I began to explain as best I could, beginning with the double desecration of Katrina's grave as the most tangible of the matters connected with what I believed to be happening. He listened without comment or interruption of any kind. I showed him Ian's letter and told him all that Silvestri had said, without revealing the priest's name. He read the letter twice, very carefully, and when he finally put it down, he seemed troubled. "Well, Andrew, you seem to have got yourself into one hell of a mess." "You believe me, then?" He snorted and shook his head. "What do you mean, do I believe all this stuff about magicians and bringing people back from the dead? Of course I don't. But I'm perfectly willing to believe that something unpleasant is going on, although actually proving anything against this chap Milne will not be easy." He sighed. "As for all the other things, look, Andrew, if you're in half as disturbed a state as you were when I last saw you..." "What about the noises in my flat?" I said. "Harriet heard them too." "I'm sure she did, but she's a recent widow, and probably quite on edge herself. Listen, I suggest you take a mild sedative and drink some more of that herbal remedy I gave you before. I'll have some made up for you to take home." "Is there nothing you can do about my father?" "I can make no promises. I'll do what I can. As for yourself, my advice is to go home now. Take two of the tablets I'm going to give you and get some rest. Now, will you do that? I nodded. Good man. Harriet was waiting when I got back to the flat. I'm sorry, I said, but I can't see Silvestri tonight. I promised Dr. McLean I'd stay in. He's given me some stuff to help me sleep. But Silvestri said he wanted to see both of us. He needs to speak to you. She shrugged. Well, I suppose it can't be helped. You do look absolutely exhausted. By the way, she went on, he wanted to know exactly how you first came into contact with Milne. He seemed to think it was important. I met him at the Fraternity of the Old Path, I said. That was how he made contact with all his potential recruits. Okay, I'll tell him that. I'll drive over and explain to him that you'll try to get over in the morning. After she had gone, I felt restless and sat reading for a while, but I couldn't concentrate. The silence in the house preyed on my nerves. Desperate to speak to someone, I called Stornoway and spoke to my mother. My father had made a slight improvement, but Dr. Boyd still insisted on having the tests done in Inverness. They would probably fly my father there in the morning. By the way, I said, Ramsay McLean will probably be getting in touch. Well, that's kind of him. He'll have been wondering about your father. Why is that? I asked. I only spoke to him about it today. Oh, your father rang him about a week ago when he was planning to visit you. He was thinking of staying with Ramsay, if there was room. I don't understand, I said. He said nothing to me today about speaking to him. Oh, you must have forgotten. Did he say if he has any idea what may be wrong? What? No, I think he wants to speak with Boyd first. Look, Mother, I have to go. If you do fly to Inverness tomorrow, will you let me know? I'm staying with Harriet Gillespie for a few days. You can call me here. I gave her Harriet's number and rang off. Why had McLean not mentioned his conversation with my father? It would have been the most natural thing to say something like, I spoke to your father only last week. He was thinking of coming to Edinburgh for a visit. But that was not what he had said. I remember now. What he had said was, I haven't heard from him in months. That was not all I remembered. My first thought when Harriet asked how I had met Duncan Milne had been one of our brushes at the meetings of the fraternity. But we had only met properly that day at the pub when he had come to my table as though by appointment. And now I remembered who had arranged for me to be there. Ramsay McLean. The doorbell rang. I sighed with relief. Harriet must have forgotten her keys. I could not have sat there much longer, a prey to every fear that decided to take hold of me. I got up and went to the door. Harriet and I had to talk. I was starting to let things get out of proportion. Perhaps I was growing paranoid, finding everyone around me somehow sinister, part of a plot. I opened the door. Ramsay McLean was standing on the step. Good evening, Andrew. I hope I'm not disturbing you. No, I was just watching television. Do you mind if I come in? No, of course not. He stepped forward into the hall. As he did so, there was a soft movement behind him. A second figure stepped forward, moving into the light. Hello, Andrew. It was Duncan Milne. He had not changed. It's time we had a little chat.